continue our board meeting with leases.
Good afternoon. Today we're going to discuss three topics on leases. That's transition, small asset leases, and then there's a small sweep issue linked to sublease discount rates. Apart from any sweep issues that might arise during the drafting process, then this will complete the more detailed technical redeliberations. And as the cover note mentions, then we will bring back in March a paper asking you for permission to ballot. I'd just like to mention that the FASB are also discussing transition this month. In fact, their meeting is next week. And so they're discussing transition as well as a couple of other topics that are mentioned in the cover note. And also just to explain that although virtually all of our redeliberations over the past year we have discussed jointly together with the FASB, we together with our FASB staff colleagues decided that we thought it would be better for the boards to discuss transition separately. And mainly that's because we view transition as being so related to the board's respective lessee models. Also in that is that the boards actually do have slightly different starting points on lessor accounting. So again, there were just some different considerations for the board in that respect. So sorry, Philippe.
On the FASB, paragraph 4 here, you mentioned transition, but also I see they are going to discuss reassessment of variable lease payments that we are not going to rediscuss, apparently. Is there any risk of divergence here, or...?
No, actually, it's the opposite, because I don't know if you remember, but one of the pieces where we don't have converged decisions with the FASB is regarding the reassessment of variable lease payments linked to an index or rate, and so this paper that will be discussed by the FASB next week is asking whether they may want to change their decision to be the same as ours in that respect.
The last is build-to-suit transactions. I have no idea what that means.
That is something that's specific to US GAAP. There is specific guidance today on what's called build-to-suit transactions, and that paper is very much linked to transition. So it discusses build-to-suit slightly more holistically, but it also then deals with the transition associated with that guidance that's in existing US GAAP that won't be there anymore. Okay?
Yep.
So with that, I'm going to hand over to Catherine on transition.
Thank you. So we've split the transition proposals into four papers, and we'll start with Agenda Paper 3A, which discusses transition requirements for those leases that were previously classified as operating leases. This is quite a lengthy and detailed paper, but I'm going to tee the whole thing up together because the recommendations are all very interlinked, and we think it will be a better discussion for talking about all elements in one. So the paper covers both lessees and lessors. As lessor accounting is going to be substantially unchanged by the new standard, we're recommending that lessors aren't required to perform any specific special transition accounting relating to their ongoing operating leases. For lessees, consistent with what was proposed in the 2013 ED, we're recommending that the new standard should permit either a fully retrospective or a modified retrospective approach. Under the modified retrospective approach, we are though proposing a number of additional transition reliefs beyond what appeared in the ED. And that's largely in the light of feedback that we've received that the modified approach in the ED didn't provide very much in the way of practical cost relief compared to a fully retrospective approach. So the recommendations in this paper are made with the goal of minimising the cost for preparers of getting their leases transitioned to the new standard and introducing some specific disclosure requirements to address the most important investor information needs in that transition year. So I'll briefly summarise the additional reliefs beyond those that were in the ED that we're proposing, and then I'll talk about disclosure. So firstly, we're recommending that a lessee should not be required to restate their comparative figures on transition, and instead they'd recognise a cumulative catch-up adjustment through retained earnings in the period of initial application. Secondly, we're recommending that a lessee should be offered a choice on a lease-by-lease basis of how to measure the right-of-use asset on transition. And that will enable entities to only perform the more accurate transition method for those leases that are significant enough to warrant the cost that that will involve. We think that the application of that choice will be largely self-policing, because the consequence of taking the less costly approach in any scenario would be a higher right of use asset on transition, and therefore a higher depreciation charge for the remainder of the asset's life. I.e. the price that a lessee would pay for taking the less costly approach would be an adverse impact on profits. The third specific relief that I'll highlight relates to the treatment of any existing onerous lease provisions. We recommend that a lessee should be permitted an option to adjust the right of use asset on transition by the amount of any previously recognised onerous lease provisions, and that would be as an alternative to performing an impairment review. Finally, we recommend that a lessee should not be required to transition those leases whose term ends within 12 months of the date of initial application, and instead they'd account for and disclose those in accordance with the short-term exemption. Given that we're recommending that that comparative figures aren't to be restated, we think that on transition those leases are similar in principle to the leases that are already captured by the short-term exemption. In terms of disclosure requirements, these are discussed in paragraphs 77 to 103. Since we posted the paper, we have had some questions on this, in light of which I'd like to provide a brief clarification on exactly what it is we're proposing in terms of disclosure. So we're recommending that year-on-year comparison should be facilitated by providing certain disclosures at the end of the year of initial application on an IAS 17 basis. And the reason for that is because we think it will be less costly than requiring any disclosure of prior year figures under the new standard. We've had a few questions about whether those IAS 17 based disclosures that we're recommending would include data relating to new leases entered into during the year of initial application, because that would require a lessee to segregate those leases between financing and operating, despite those classifications not being relevant under the new leases standard. So to clarify, the IAS 17 figures that are recommended in this paper are on the basis of rolling forward existing IAS 17 records for one more year, and that information would not include any new leases, i.e. we would not be expecting a lessee to classify those leases under the IAS 17 requirements. We think that information about new leases entered into during the transition year will be available firstly via disclosure of additions to right of use assets, and secondly by virtue of the explanatory requirement we've got about the impact of adopting the new standard that's described in paragraphs 90C and 91 of the paper. The last section of the paper talks about those reliefs that we recommend also permitting for first-time adopters of IFRS. So with that, I'll hand over to the board for discussion.
Could I just start with your last point first? In the IAS 17 disclosures, so you'll have a figure that says that the leases that were on the balance sheet at the beginning of the year or at the end of last year,
yeah,
how much rent would you have paid if you'd, would you have expensed if you'd followed IAS 17? But for everything that's been added on during the year, you just treat it under the new. So what's that figure going to mean? I mean, anybody reading it, how do they know what it... What, I mean, it's a bit of the total, but I don't see it's all that meaningful or very helpful.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, and we have considered many alternative disclosure options to try and get to a point where a user could have a way of comparing year on year without a preparer having to do either of running parallel systems or having effectively an additional sort of hard close date that might be a way of doing it on day one. So we think that this provides a balance in that information about new leases in the year will be evident from other disclosures that we've got, both those that were discussed last month and will appear every year.
But not an IAS 17. I mean, I agree that you shouldn't have to do the.
Yeah.
I just think we just should do away with the disclosure, because I think it's a figure that's not going to mean anything.
Ian, I'm trying to remember back to last month in the discussions of disclosures. And I thought that one of the requirements was to report separately in your disclosure the amount that relate, you know, under the new standard, that relates to leases that were in existence at the date of initial application. Or the other way around, because you are splitting out small ticket and because you're splitting out new, you'd also have a number that's for the existing leases. And that would let you say, I'm not saying it's critical that we have this, but I think what Catherine was pointing to is that that's why you'd have a point of comparison for the pool of leases that was there at the beginning of the year. What's their measurement under 17, and what's their measurement under the new standard? I think you have a point of comparison. It's just a question of what you think the value of that is.
I don't think it's any use to anybody in doing any analysis.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of what we decided would be required last month, you have got additions to right of use assets in the year, which would effectively give an indication of the extent to which there's been new leasing activity. So, you know, we are acknowledging that this disclosure is a compromise, but we think that between that disclosure and knowing about the population that was there in the previous year, there would be a comparison to be used, albeit that it wouldn't be perfect.
So if I understand, firstly, I agree with all of your recommendations in here. I just had one question about what the nature of the disclosure would be that's to help users in place of comparators. So if I understand correctly what's proposed, and let's put dates on it because it makes it easier for me to think about. Let's assume that I was applying it from the 1st of January 2018. We'd be saying that when you prepared your financial statements ending the 31st of December 2018, you could do a reconciliation along the lines of, these were my IAS 17 operating lease commitments, this is my weighted average discount rate, so I can get an idea of what you might prima facie expect to come on the balance sheet. Then maybe you'd have your IAS 17 finance lease amount, so that's sort of your starting bit, yep. Place, your anchor.
Yep.
Then you might say, okay, now I've got a certain amount that's off because of the short-term lease exemption, the small asset potentially, and then plus or minus the sort of net change in the volume of the change in the volume of leasing activities, and that sort of might give you an idea of how you got from one to the other. So you can see how much has changed in accounting versus change in activity, if you like. That's sort of what you're thinking. As an alternative, I went back and had a look at what we did with IFRS 9, because we did a similar thing in IFRS 9 where we said, okay, because of the complexity of changes in hedge accounting and all the other noise we've got going on, we won't require you to restate comparatives, but to help users of financial statements, we'll help with a disclosure that explains how you stepped from one model to the other. But what we did there was said, okay, going back to my dates, on the 31st of December 2017, this is what my numbers looked like. On the 1st of January 2018, this is what my opening numbers look like, because then I don't have the noise of the change in the level of activity. So why didn't you suggest that?
There's a few reasons why we didn't suggest that, and I would basket them into two primary categories. So the first reason is that we do think there would be a certain amount of cost associated with doing day one of transition year disclosures. I can give more detail on this if needed, but briefly, what would generally be required, accepting that there's many different systems and processes, is that the opening balance adjustment would need to go in and then some form of hard close to lock those numbers down before the 2018 transactions started going through would be necessary, and then the process of getting that lockdown position into an auditable stage would likely have associated costs. So we do think there will be some cost associated with that. And the second related point I would make is we do believe that for transition of leases, we have a unique option in a sense, in that in any normal transition scenario, if only such a thing existed, you're going to be going from one set of double entry accounting to an alternative set of double entry accounting, and the only way to compare two positions is either to run parallel systems for a period so that you land in the same place under the two approaches, or to do what you've described, i.e. have a lockdown on day one or any other date that gives you an extra set of information. And either way, to get a system to run either parallel data or to have an extra closed position is going to have some cost associated with it. And normally, you know, you have to pick one or the other. With leases, because the comparative information we're moving from, i.e. operating lease commitments, are outside of any double entry system, no matter what accounting system you use, it doesn't introduce any extra system requirement to keep that running for a period of time. So we believe we've effectively here got this unique third alternative, which we believe will be less costly than the other two approaches, which is to allow whatever separate system is tracking operating leases today to continue for 1 year and perform a reconciliation at the end of that year. Now that is accepting that reconciliation will have an extra item, which is effectively new leases in the year, but we believe that because that would not require any system element, that third option, which is unique to leases, will be less costly than anything else, and that's why we think it's different.
I do want, and I can see there's an incremental cost of getting numbers that are firm enough, if you like, to be shown in a disclosure in a set of audited financial statements, but the numbers that you would need to do that comparison, which I think has part of what I think Ian was alluding to, you've got a lot of noise because of a year's worth of activity going on that you've got to explain. Whereas if you do it at a point in time, that only changes your accounting. And you do need to have those numbers as an anchor to start applying the accounting, because I still need to have got all those operating lease commitments into the measurement to start my opening entry adjustment to transition in. So I can hear that there is an incremental cost, but on the flip side, we're asking users to give up the niceties of comparatives in exchange for this. So I think we need to watch the benefits as well.
Yeah, that's fair.
Thank you for the explanation.
I think I detected a subtle change in the recommendation when you were teeing it up. If so, I think you resolved my problem. But so am I correct in saying that the requirement to adjust the opening balance by the onerous amount is an option, not a requirement? No.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Back to the point that Jan raised about the comparability of the P&L over the 2 years. For the new leases entered into in the year of first application, which will be capitalized under our proposal, can you remind me, in terms of disclosures, what we require about the cash rent expense of those leases in the period? Because if really you want to understand the two P&Ls, they are not comparable, because the old ones would first be either exempted because they are short-term or are due to expire in the year, so they will be still in the P&L. New ones will be capitalized, and the P&L expense will be under a different model. And in the previous year, they were all were expensed. So they are not comparable anyhow. And disclosing only the rent expense for the ones which move to the new model in the current year and not for the new ones is not providing full comparability, as we understand. So what kind of additional disclosures are there to understand, really, to try to go beyond that and try to have a better understanding of the P&L impact of the two different years?
In answer to the specific question that you started with, which is what disclosure decisions were made on the P&L, it's effectively the interest cost and the amortization cost, and then separate numbers for short term, small ticket, etc. So you are absolutely right that nowhere within that is P&L cost for new leases in the year, and that does mean that there won't be a way to get one correct figure for that. The way we're thinking about this is that there are enough disclosures that the level of new leasing activity relative to what's already there will be clear from the financial statements. So this is absolutely by no means a perfect comparison, but ultimately in making the recommendation, we have taken the judgment that some compromises in terms of having data that will get you to a reasonable place rather than perfect data is worth it for the cost.
So the concern is that, as we know, that in certain situations there will be an appearance of comparability, but it could be misleading because there will not be comparability, even with the disclosures of the rent for the theoretical rent for the current period. Is that a way to say that this information should be presented with some qualifiers or caution or a warning that it is not intended to provide full comparability? In certain situations, it could even be misleading. Because I think people will try on that basis to say, oh, let's have a first look. Yes, I've got information, so I conclude that I can do this restatement. It might be wrong.
It's a bit strange to require a disclosure which we say, you must say, could be misleading.
Yeah, I think it could be misleading in certain cases for those who stop there. Yeah. And so the question is, either we don't do it,
yeah,
or we do it with a messaging that it's not intended to provide.
You can't read it or use it.
But sometimes it could be of use, but not always. That's a problem. Yeah.
Just to add, I was just going to add one point, Philippe, if it's helpful, I don't know, but one of the other things disclosed in the first year as well will be the total cash flow. So you'll get the expense numbers, of course, for everything, not split out for new activity and separate, but for everything, you know, from the date of transition, you would get the, you know, interest, amortization, other pieces, and also the total cash flow would be there, which might be helpful as well.
So I'm uncomfortable with the lack of retrospective application, as I mentioned to you. It seems to me that when we introduce this new leasing standard, the financial statements are going to change quite noticeably, balance sheet and income statement, if leases are significant. Balance sheet, the leverage, the fixed assets, the debt, income statement, margins, interest expense versus operating expenses, return on capital, lots of things are going to change. And I think we have to think very carefully before we present two sets of financial statements next to each other that look very, very different, even though the economics haven't changed. I think it's quite different from revenue recognition, for example. So we permitted this approach for revenue recognition, but the old revenue recognition gave a revenue number and the new one gives a revenue number. It doesn't change the appearance of the financial statements. And in many cases, the revenue number won't be that different. And particularly when you take into account the fact of open portfolios and the sort of the averaging effect for revenue, it's going to be even less different. IFRS 9, I think, is similar. Sure, the impairment is different before and after, but when you take into account the open portfolio nature, again, it may not be that different in terms of the P&L. It might be a bit more difference in the balance sheet. So I think we are dealing with a different situation. So that's why I think this proposal goes a little bit too far in the interests of cost benefit, and I would like to have restated comparative figures. However, I think you can easily do it, because all you need to do is to apply your modified approach, but 1 year earlier. And I don't think that adds much to the complexity. So the incremental borrowing rate that you use to discount all of your lease payments is not at the beginning of the year of transition, it's 12 months earlier. And you apply everything else that you've got here, but just 12 months earlier. And does that really add much to the difficulty of transition? I think it would make a massive difference in the usability of the financial statements for the investors.
Okay, we did give that a lot of consideration. I ultimately did conclude that what we proposed is a preferable option. There's a couple of reasons for that. The first thing I would say is that the four additional reliefs that I've described in the TEOP wouldn't translate directly to being applied a year earlier. So the four additional reliefs beyond what were in the EDIA, firstly comparatives, which would of course go. The right of use asset measurement improvement could apply a year earlier, so that one would be there, as could the onerous leases, because that wasn't covered in the ED. However, the 12-month one, which was something that was very popular in feedback and was suggested quite a lot, we don't believe could realistically be applied 12 months earlier, because you would lose 2 years and it would be a bigger exemption than the short term.
Well, you can still apply 12 months, but 12 months earlier.
Okay. The other comment I'd make is that, as just described, of the four reliefs, you know, not all of them would be applicable in this circumstance. And ultimately, what was proposed in the ED was a modified retrospective approach starting at the beginning of the comparative year, as you're describing.
But your new version is much easier.
it's one of the reasons it's much easier is because of the comparative piece.
No, even without that, it's still easier.
Okay, could I? Okay, so. So we.
Broader.
So we received a lot of feedback on the proposal that was in the ED, an awful lot. And that feedback, I would say, across the board, stated that the modified retrospective approach, as proposed, would not give much cost relief as compared to a full retrospective. And we had a lot of suggestions for ways that that modified retrospective approach could be improved. And the ones that we got an awful lot of, because they were the ones that would make a real practical difference in cost terms, were the comparative piece and the 12-month piece. And those are the two that wouldn't translate. So I think everything that you've said about the reasons why we'd want comparative restatement, we completely agree with. But ultimately, we believe that there is a judgment to be made here about the amount of difficulty that carers are going to have in that first year, and that's going to be an extremely high level come what may. And we think acknowledging fully the compromises that this means for the reported information, and knowing that even the disclosure we've got is far from perfect, we still think that the costs are so significant that we think what we proposed is the preferable option.
One more thing. If we were to delay the effective date by 1 year and did what I've just suggested, why is there any difference in cost compared with your approach?
Parallel systems.
There's no parallel systems. Because...
No, there still would be.
Yeah.
It's exactly the same.
You would, for 1 year, have to report under the old accounting, because you would have the year before you adopt, and then the next year that same year.
You've got that in your approach because you're still keeping the operating lease systems going for one more year, so you also have parallel reporting.
I would have to disagree with that, because all we are all we are proposing to keep rolling is the information that gets you to operating lease commitments. Operating these commitments are nowhere within the double entry system. So the double entry system, until the day before the date of initial application under what we're proposing, would be IAS 17, and that would be the end of it. From the following day, it would be the new system, and that would be the end of it. The proposal that you're making would mean that, to use the dates that Sue mentioned earlier, up to 31 December 2017, you would need your double entry system to operate on an IAS 17 basis. Come the following year, you would need to have rerun that entire year, that set of financial statements, on the basis of the new standard. And so for that 1 year ended 31 December 2017, you would need the same set of financial statements run on two different bases, and therefore parallel systems.
But the finance lease system will just carry on before and after.
In the sense that the new proposals are effectively finance leases.
You're processing entries twice for operating leases, once under the new approach and once under the old approach.
But the big benefit of that is we get comparatives.
That's right.
But the price to pay is to delay the effective date,
right?
Price to pay to delay the effective date by 1 year. Is that a benefit? Is that a cost for investors?
And I'll be honest, I would have taken the opposite view to the one you did when you were thinking about revenue and IFRS 9. In some ways, the difficulty with revenue and IFRS 9 is the changes are quite subtle. So if you're not keeping your eye on it, you might not even realize the changes have actually happened unless you've had your attention drawn to them. In this case, the changes are significant enough that you know something's happened, and that helps to bring people into the process of trying to understand what has changed. So I think sometimes a bigger change like this is more open to it.
Stephen almost admits defeat, but not quite.
Yeah. No way. That was a nod of disagreement.
Yes, I disagree.
Yeah, the last one is
okay, Gary.
Thank you. It actually, as you know, I support the staff's recommendation. I think the work you did with, you know, amending the modified retrospective approach with more staff work, I think was the creative and went far and wide trying to get buy-in to it. And I take looking at paragraph 12 in acknowledging, you know, Stephen's point and perhaps other investors' points is, so I'm reading this as they sort of acknowledge this is going to be really expensive to do and can live with this. It, I think, you know, I think where preparers still have the obligation to explain their financial statements. So if leases are extremely material and they just show up there in one year but not the other, although it might not be on the face of the financial statements, they're not going to get away with not explaining it. Now your footnote helps, you know, paragraph 90, but they can't avoid the issue with, you know, assuming leases are off, today's off balance sheet leases are material. I think they will be forced to, by force of the marketplace and analyst expectations, to come up with at least a roughly right answer. Are the leases getting more of them, less of them, you know, more costly, less costly? So I think that will be something we don't have to put in the standard, but I think it will be there. You know, and if they're immaterial, well, then no one really cares. So assuming a January 1st, 2018 effective date is, and I'm not an expert on how for interim reporting or IFRS, but the first full year to the end of 2018, but the public companies, you're going to have a quarterly or a semi-annual statement during 2018. Would you view this as being effective for them, or is this really effective at the end of the year for the year that happens to begin on the 1st of January?
I would say end of the year, but
So if you had a March or a June balance in that year, that would not be, you would not have the effect of the new standard on those balance sheets at the end of their balance sheet.
It'll be subject to the principles in 34, so I think you'd need to stop and think whether our users need more information to understand.
Yes, I'm just not
I mean, yeah, so to clarify clearly, transition will happen in your first reporting period, if we assume, again, effective date of 1st January 2018, you are already applying the new requirements, of course, from 1st January 2018. So whatever your first, which might be an interim reporting period after that, then the new requirements, et cetera, would apply. And so I suppose we're not suggesting anything special here for interims, but
But otherwise, this argument of switching system will not work. If you have to, the first quarter in 2018, have to, on the old standard, but the full year on the new, you have to run parallel systems. This advantage can only happen if you have then the first quarter in that year already on the new standards.
And the tradition would,
We're not proposing requiring all the disclosures.
Well, I think instead of saying CIS 34, what these we actually might want to be explicit in the standard, how we expect the first year's interim to be handled.
Yes, so just to agree with you, Martin, I mean, absolutely all the accounting would switch as from 1st of January in that year. Yeah. I think we were just thinking about potentially the disclosure.
I'm really raising because I know typically our stuff is written in the context of an annual statement, whereas FASB usually has interim sections in every standard and just tell it to bridge.
Yeah, so maybe just to clarify, what we'll do is we'll check 34 our ideas. We wouldn't put anything special in leases for interim periods beyond what's in IS 30.
But I would still carry it forward into whatever the standard number is, both saying CIS 34, even if it's just repeating what's there, as I think it's important enough.
Doug.
Thank you. I appreciate staff's recommendation, and I agree with all of the staff's proposal. And especially, I appreciate the treatment of first-time adopters. You gave the same exemption to the first-time adopters, but we have to give up, you know, restatement of comparative figures and 12-month exemption. That's inevitable because we don't know what kind of accounting standard they are using before they are switching to IFRS. But can I ask just a silly question? So if you are switching from US GAAP to IFRS, so do you require the retrospective comparative figures?
If you were doing that, you would be a first time adopter, so,
right,
so yes.
Right, okay, yeah. So then how about the country like India? I'm not sure about new Indian standard, but they are going to use basically IFRS with some carve-outs. What if IS 17 has been adopted in India without any modification at all? Then even in such case, do you require retrospective comparative figure?
If you're not coming from IFRS, then.
Yeah. If you're still a first-time adopter.
First-time adopter, right. Okay. Okay, then.